It's Wednesday, September 15th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 204 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
So a while back, we did a LARP roundtable where we kind of admitted there's only so much we know about LARPing, and we got some people from the outside to come in and give us a little bit of education. And one of the other ideas we've been kicking around is doing some international roundtables, probably grouping them together by time zones just to make it easiest to schedule. And this is our first one of these, maybe our last, maybe the first in a series. I guess it just depends on how this one goes and how they're received. But for this one, we are hitting folks that are more or less along GMT. So first off, we have joining us Itamar.
Hi there.
Itamar, you want to tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and what you do in the gaming world?
Okay, my name is Itamar Weisberg, if I pronounce it with my accent.
Can you pronounce without your accent now?
Itamar Weisberg. And I'm from Israel. I'm the steady host for the last 3 years of the Hebrew gaming podcast, also called Hamishakia. And I'm a gamer. I'm a big-time gamer. Role-playing games, board games, computer games, everything.
And for any of you that are interested in looking up that show, I will go ahead and put a link to it in the show notes. So if you're trying to figure out that spelling, don't wreck your car.
Yeah, Google is not your friend.
Itamar, am I correct that you guys have recently started experimenting with some English language ones as well?
It's actually not recently. Over the last year and a half, I've been sporadically doing some English language interviews because a lot of people in the gaming industry are American, and there are even interviews from last Gen Con and Gen Con 2008 in English.
Next up, we have Jenny.
Hello.
Jenny, you want to tell us the same stuff? Who you are, where you're from, what you do?
All right. My name is Jenny, and I'm a regular Swedish gamer and artist, and that's pretty much it. I don't have any podcasts. I have an internet gallery, pretty much. I've been gaming since I was 11 and LARPing, and so my main gamer influences are like role-playing games, Pokemon, and text-based internet games, because I'm from a part of the country that isn't very densely populated.
Now, one of the things that I warned you I was going to make you do is pronounce your forum handle, because if you look at it phonetically, at least through American eyes, it reads about like a seizure. So I'm curious if you would mind, for the sake of the folks that use the forum, if you would pronounce your handle.
Well, I pronounce it Sakal, which is what my mother told me it would sound like. Other Swedes pronounce it Shakal, which means jackal, so I sound like a furry. And when I started using it as a gender-neutral forum handle in general on the internet, it was because it had an X in the beginning, which is pretty, well, you can remember it, and it ends with Hal. So you can shorten it to Hal, or X-Hal, or in some cases, X-Hale, because people have bad humor. So it's not meant to be said, it's meant to be written. It was my randomized first character name for Baldur's Gate 2 when I was 11.
And then last up is Shane.
Hello.
And Shane, same routine.
Okay, I'm in Ireland, and I've been gaming for about 13 years. I've tried out lots of different stuff, and I guess, interestingly, I've gamed in a few different countries. I lived in the US for a while, and I spent some time in Australia. I was a paid-up member of the Perth Gamers Guild. Hello to them, if there's anybody listening.
What took you to Australia?
A plane.
What?
Could it be a boat? You don't know.
My stated objective at the time was random encounters and experience points, and I got plenty of those.
Nice. Did your boots drop?
I beg your pardon?
It's a World of Warcraft joke. You kill something until the gear you want appears on a monster.
I'm taking points off of chance. Stop it.
Hey, you're the one who made the plane joke.
Well, I was funny.
It's like talking to Geppetto. If you've ever actually read the book Pinocchio, not seen the Disney movie, read the book, within the first few pages, he's having a conversation with somebody else, and there's a line where the other guy asks him, "So what brings you here?" And he replies, "My legs." What we want to talk about within this podcast is some of the differences that exist between the American gaming scene and the gaming scene in other countries. And one of the things that I'd like to start with is LARPing. It's fairly common knowledge, even outside of the Nordic countries, that there is a really visible LARP scene there that exists in some fashion here in America, but it does not exist on that scale, with these really elaborate costumed LARPs. It seemed to be mostly fantasy, but not entirely so. There's pictures out there, for example, from a Russian Fallout LARP mm-hmm. that got quite a bit of play around the internet. But I was wondering if we could go ahead and start there. And Jenny, would you mind kicking this one off and talking a little bit about what the LARP scene is like over there?
Well, all right. I've been LARPing since I was 11. And a lot of episodes ago, you were talking about how you LARP Skies of Glass or Battletech or whatever it was in some abandoned house with having character sheets just lying about. Then you were like moving around in the house and acting and stuff. Am I?
Yes, yeah. That's absolutely correct.
You said that we were actually LARPing, which sounded very strange in my ears because that sounds like regular role-playing games to me. Because if you LARP in Sweden, you generally do not need your character sheets. The only rules that often implemented is like easy combat rules. You have 3 hit points. If you get hit, you get hurt. So the fantasy LARPs aren't rules heavy at all, and you don't often have a character sheet. You have a character description you send in to the ones arranging the LARP, and they'll send you something they call an intrigue, which is pretty much your plot. For this LARP, you think that this is happening and you suspect this person of doing this, sort of to just kickstart it, sort of. Well, and I think it's a bit higher standard on the equipment, too. And we have a lot of places where you can LARP, because we have our countries like mountains and one large forest and some cities splotched into it at random.
How did you get involved in your first LARP? Because even for a tabletop role-playing game, which is certainly more common over here than LARPing is, 11's an awfully early age, but not an unheard-of age. But that's an age typically before most people would get into this.
Well, when I was a kid, I was reading a lot, and my mother noticed I liked fantasy, and so did she. So she saw her younger brother in the local newspaper had just started a LARPing group together with some friends and said, "Jenny, you like fantasy. How about you go play these fantasy role-playing games?" But, "Oh, Mom, I don't want to play games. I want to read." And so my mother forced me to start LARPing.
That and later is the best mother ever.
Of course she is. She bought a Nintendo before I was born so she would have something to do while pregnant.
Awesome.
So I like my mother quite a lot, but I have to explain something about Swedish union culture to explain Swedish gaming at all, actually, because unions, or clubs you could call them, are a pretty strong concept, and most gaming is in gaming clubs, because if you have a little union of like at least 5 people, there is this large umbrella organization, the Swedish Gamers Union, that helps you get some money from the state, so taxpayers' money pretty much, to sort of have fun with your hobby. The same way football clubs and other hobby organizations would. So most LARPing is actually these organizations, which makes it pretty easy to get into one, because they will have an organization you can look up, and it won't be like just a pack of friends. Well, if there is a pack of friends, they will be very easy to get into, because there is this formality about the friend group where they have to have like annual meetings and board of directors, pretty much the wrong word, but a board and stuff.
I'd love to hear a little more about that. So there is actually a union or some kind of a very large organization.
Guild,
yeah,
club.
A guild or a club.
Yes, it has like 90,000 members, I think. The name is Sverok in Swedish. Sveriges Roll- och Konfliktspelsförbund.
That will not be in the show notes.
I've yet to find a good English translation to the word förening, because it can be translated as society, association, union, or club. And it's pretty much a few people, one that is the sort of chairman, one that is a secretary, and one that takes care of the money, and at least 2 more that it takes to build one of these clubs under Sverok. And you get a little money each year. It's like, I think it's $400 or something to buy games and stuff, or to rent a little club house or something, I don't know. Whatever you want to do with it. But it's not money for a private person, it's money for the club. It's sort of, it doesn't go to people, it goes to the hobby itself. And the larger you get a little bit more money for each member or something from this umbrella organization. And Sverok is actually one of the largest, if not the largest, youth organization in Sweden.
So there's actually a built-in, and I don't want to get too much caught up in the politics of this, but there is a built-in reason for these clubs to keep growing and keep attracting new members, because this actually expands what they can do. This is very different mm-hmm. than the gaming culture in America, which has the reverse thing, and particularly until the advent of the internet, the gaming culture here was very cellular. It was groups got together and did what they and their friends wanted.
What I find interesting is what you had said, Jenny, is that this is the largest youth organization in your country.
Yes.
Whereas in America, there is built-in gamer shame. People don't want to talk about gaming. They don't want to talk about they're into hobby board gaming. They don't want to talk about that they're into role-playing games. And that's why it's so cellular, to the point where our shame of gaming, well, not mine, I'm not very a shameful person, but it pushes it underground to a certain extent.
One thing that helped was that there was a book published in the 90s called The Army of the Abandoned, in translation, that talked about how gaming and role-playing games would make your children satanistic and kill people. And it was like a cult stuff. And which, of course, meant that Sverok gained several thousand new members after the publication. But in general, there is this built-in way for gaming to get larger, which doesn't actually necessarily help right now, because the role-playing market is, of course, in decline today, but the organization gets bigger. New for this year is they have to like have a member's fee or something like that, which they didn't need earlier. So you join pretty much any club for free. But this is what socialism looks like, all right? Socialism is good for gaming.
Free gaming for all.
Don't people hate big umbrella organizations? I mean, there's something similar to that idea in Ireland, just like a small group with the sort of broad and non-intrusive aim of promoting gaming. And people are vehemently opposed to it because they're telling us how to have fun.
No, because the only thing Sverok tells you is that you need to do some bookkeeping and you need to show what you've bought for this money, sort of. And if you want more money, if you want funding for a project or for a LARP or for some sort of educational project or whatever you can do within Sverok, you have to write it up and ask formally for the money and they'll give it to you, pretty much. They don't actually get into how you have fun.
They don't dictate to you what games you have to play. They don't dictate to you that you even have to game certain times, certain amounts of people and such.
You should have some sort of activity, but you don't have to have very much. And you only have to have like one annual meeting to keep the club alive.
Do people try and scam the club? Do you think that there are people who, they get their equivalent of $400 a year, they rent a clubhouse and they just eat pizzas and drink beer and they just tell the organization, hey, whatever.
If they still do the bookkeeping, and if they're still sort of gamers, and they've used this money to rent a clubhouse or something, that's perfectly all right. Because whatever you want to call a game, I mean, it's they do investigate sometimes that you're actually not scamming.
Well, in Israel, we solved this problem, because the Israeli Role Playing Game Association gets absolutely no money from the government or any other public figure. So, yeah, we have an association, and I'm a member, and I really don't know how much of the gaming public is part of it, but there is, like Jenny said, three people who are the guy with the purse, the guy who is in the head, and a secretary, and like there's an election every year or so, and they put on the conventions, and that's it. There is no money involved, and there is nothing much other than that.
Well, is that a private organization? Or is that one that's
sponsored? Yes, it's a non-profit organization, a volunteer.
Sverok has like two or three employees, one of which is the chairman for the entire organization, one of it is the secretary. And then they have an office where they have some employees too, but that's just for administrative work. Other than that, it's actually a non-profit organization. But there have been people who scammed this organization, but there have been very few. And some of the minor scams is actually pretty benign. If you want to end your club, you can do it. The stuff you've amassed from this money you get should ideally go to some other club. But if you can't be arsed, or if you're not close to any one of them, it usually ends up in gamers' basements. But it's not really seen as a problem.
Shane, you started talking about a gaming organization that exists in, well, I'll presume Ireland. Was it just in Ireland, or is this all over the UK?
Yeah, no, this is the Irish Games Association, and I would imagine it's similar to the Israeli one. I'm a member of this one, but, well, frankly, it doesn't really do a whole lot. We do put on one big, well, big by our standards convention each year, and run a few smaller events, like primarily centered around Dublin, because just for logistical reasons, that's where most of the members are, like, you know, biggest population concentration, I suppose. There's a weekly meeting in a pub in town that we've got like a floor booked out. So you can come there and run a role-playing games, or there's a bit of a war game scene there as well. But apart from that, apart from being hated, there's not much more to it.
Why do people hate it? Is it just because they think that this organization that is voluntary, non-profit, non-governmental, they think that they're going to kick down their door and tell them how to play their games? Or oh, yeah. Why is it?
Oh, yeah, no, that's a good reason, isn't it?
So they have, like, clubs to break kneecaps?
Is there any truth to that? Or is it just, like, some conspiracy theory that popped up?
No, having seen this committee operate, they are far too lazy to get anything like that done. I mean, if it was kneecaps to be broken, I'd be on board, but it's not going to happen.
Think the biggest difference between the one in Sweden and the ones in Israel and Ireland is that the one in Sweden, I mean, for the cons, I've heard you both mention that your organization arranges conventions. What mm-hmm. Sverok does is give cash and help to the clubs that organizes the conventions.
And the fact that you have full-time employees who get
and
money.
And the fact that we have like 3 or 5 full-time employees, and that we actually, Sverok first was actually created to make it easier to get money to the gaming hobby. And the main largest Swedish conventions have to abide by a few rules, because these clubs can cooperate with different umbrella organizations, not only Sverok. A one that was popular in my hometown was the Soberity Union, which meant that gaming and alcohol, for me, it just doesn't go together, because I've been so used to, well, it not having anything to do with each other. And since Sverok is a youth organization, Sverok-funded cons, for example, doesn't actually have... Well, I'm not sure if there's actually a rule, but I think that if you want to get Sverok money, you can't serve alcohol and stuff, because recently, I mean, people below the age of 18 will be there. You get this money from the state for every member that is between the ages 7 and 25.
Shane, so, I'm guessing there is no rule against alcohol in Ireland?
They meet in a pub. I mean,
which makes it surprising for me to hear. I mean, initially surprising that, an American convention is you go somewhere and you drink a lot of alcohol and you look at cosplayers. Because...
Well, that's just Fear the Boot.
I know.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
Because that was the sort of initial surprise that, do they serve alcohol at conventions? Oh my gosh. But...
It's not mandatory. It's just recommended.
And I think some of what you're hearing also is the fact that there are really two parts to a con experience. There's the stuff you do, and then there's the stuff that's worth talking about. When I was at Gen Con, I did go out and get some drinks. We did go around, and I was with Pat, so we did talk to a lot of cosplayers. But I spent also quite a bit of time doing things like gaming.
Ran several Star Trek games.
I wasn't suggesting you were boozing away your conventions. I was mostly reacting to the fact that there were...
We were boozing away our convention, but that was just kind of us.
I'm trying to be diplomatic. I'm removing 3 more points from you.
I'm not going to have any
points by the end
of this.
There isn't any actual alcohol in the convention center in Gen Con.
Oh, yeah, there was.
There was the White Wolf,
the White Wolf booth.
Yeah.
The White Wolf booth had a bar, which that was unusual. That was a first. I've never before seen a full-service bar in the middle of the convention hall. But I wonder if this is something that is very culturally based, because it's a quirk of most Americans that we are very skeptical of authority in any form. It's just the way we are. And listening to Shane talk, I have no doubt this is something we brought with us from our shared ancestry on those little isles.
And we're socialists.
Well, and exactly. And if I look at, for example, the way that it sounds like these game organizations are put together within Ireland and America, it sounds like Israel as well. They are very bottom up. That a gaming group gets together, starts gaming. That's even where our games come from. That eventually they create a homebrew. A homebrew became Dungeons and Dragons, turns into a company. Eventually this company starts hosting a convention at Lake Geneva, which comes to be known as Gen Con, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, of course, not the actual Geneva. But
Americans can't think of original names for places and just copy from other places.
Yeah, exactly. And,
they have like 4 Stockholms.
But it sounds like in Sweden, it's quite the reverse, that this was organized from the top down, that an organization...
Yes and no, but go on.
Even if it wasn't started from the top down, that it currently exists and grows and sustains itself from the top down.
Yeah, pretty much. But then again, it's also dwindling a little bit since we kicked out the paintballers, I think. I think it's either paintball or airsoft that is not considered a game anymore, but a sport.
Because paintballers.
Because of something that Sphero can't really control.
That surprised me a bit. I was in Sweden a few months ago for an airsoft. A very high standard of LARPing, like a large amount of it was LARP. It was kind of, you know, you could join a military force on one of the two sides, or you could play a civilian, and that was often a purely LARP role. So there's all this stuff going on in the middle. But
I think I do not remember this correctly, but I think it's paintball that's considered a sport, because airsoft is true, it's used in some reenactments too. And reenactment and LARP are considered games, of course. But the reason that I brought up this in the first place was because I started to LARP within one of these clubs. And the LARPs that are organized in Sweden are usually get some funding from this organization, which makes it a little bit easier to get a place to LARP. And you can also ask the municipalities for like project funding and so on. So it's easier to get the money to LARP in Sweden. For the organizations, not for the person, because LARP is still a very, very expensive hobby.
Only if you have proper equipment and clothes.
Yes, but if you don't have proper equipment, you shouldn't LARP.
if you just have a bit of sponge on a pipe and use that.
There are, of course, LARPs with lower standards too, just to show people what it's about. And there are LARPs for like kids, so they can play around. And there are LARPs with high standards. You have all kinds of LARPs, but generally it looks to me like the physical standard sort of for authenticity or similar attributes in Swedish and Nordic LARPing is a little bit, well, it's a little bit bigger than in the US.
I just use a little bit of duct tape to pad a lead pipe and you're ready to go.
Lead pipe.
You know,
I want to go to that LARP.
I find it really interesting that in America, we cannot go to any state, local, federal government and get any kind of funds for role-playing games. It's just not how America works.
For much of any hobby. Yeah.
It's very difficult to get a grassroots organization that's sort of a gaming guild or club going that's beyond just your friends and your one group of games, beyond just something that is maybe a high school gaming club. And those usually just evolve into just a group of friends gaming. And it is certainly out of the question to go into a bar or pub here in America and lay down and start role playing. And that's just, we'd get probably thrown out.
Exactly like that. We're not talking your Dark Lord of Denny's here.
I
think that you, Shad, particularly would actually like these LARPs because you don't seem to care much for formal rules. And even the vampire LARPs, we have pretty much a vampire LARPs too, they toss out the White Wolf system, the Mind's Eye Theater, because they think it's too gamistic. It sort of breaks the feeling of the illusion, so to speak, because it's too gamistic and too intrusive. Instead, you use like very subtle hand signals, if anything at all. So I think you particularly would actually like this because it is, well, it's interactive acting and you don't have to look at papers at all. You just make it up on the top of your head.
You know, I think I'm in a really bad place when it comes to LARPing because in Missouri, in St. Louis, there is virtually no LARP scene going on. I mean, if there is, it's a bunch of friends and it is a very, what would you would consider low standards or low quality of LARP. And while I could probably hook into something like that, I've seen the other side of the fence. I've been to these LARP websites and blogs and talked to people who have been in these like European LARPs that are very intricate and very cool. And that just doesn't exist here. And if I were to LARP...
Or we're not aware of it.
Or we're not aware of it. I mean,
it's called the SCA.
Yeah. Well, see, that's just it. Over here in America,
call them LARPers and see how they like it.
Yeah.
Actually, the SCA, we a lot of LARPers actually look down on the SCA in Sweden because they're not doing it real enough.
Well, and vice versa. Yeah, the SCA would get mad that if you call them LARPers, and the LARPers would get mad if you called the SCA LARPers.
And then there's like Nero, and then there's the other organizations. And in America, it just seems like when you get into that, it's less about the role play, the dialogue, the story.
It's sparring.
It's combat. And it's really cool combat. I'm not downing it. In fact, I used to do that sort of thing, but not with an SCA thing. But
just with a lead pipe?
Yeah.
Lead pipe, a little bit of duct tape.
Listen, there are parts of St. Louis that are really, really rough. But
I think that vampire LARPers in general are very good at English. So if you ever want to try one of these Scandinavian LARPs, I could pick you up at the airport.
If I'm ever find myself in Europe, I would love to take you up on that offer.
I figured here at some point, Carl and I have been talking for our past, I don't know how many vacations, we've hit the Caribbean. So we've talked about hitting Europe. And I figure through the podcasting thing, I know enough people in Europe that I would probably be able to blog some interesting stuff from over
Dan,
there.
Dan, I'll give you a warning. You can't bring your lead pipe to Europe.
I know, so I'm bringing the AK. So
yeah.
But it's all right. You can find plenty of lead pipes just laying around.
I'll just hit a hardware store. Yeah. And
hit Eastern Europe first, and you'll find a lot.
You can do a podcasting travel show. A travel between podcast to podcast.
There you go.
The LARP scene in Israel, it's a bit bipolar because there has been LARPing for quite a few years, mainly the buffer weapons, D&D style for a lot of years. And then in the 90s, there was a large wave of immigration of Russian Jews to Israel. And they brought with them the LARP experience from Russia, which means the expensive costumes and armor and all the things that go with it. I was actually in one of the little tiny forest Israel has a few years ago in a Lord of the Rings LARP, which had like 500 participants. And we were a group of Israeli originated people playing as the Lothlorien elves. And all the rest of the people were Russian born, and they had beautiful, beautiful equipment. And we had some, I had a fun time. And actually there's a LARP coming up later this month where the same group of people, they are going to do a very large population LARP of Song of Ice and Fire. So I know the European or the Russian effect, and which is very impressive.
And I know for a fact that Shane has actually been to a LARP last night, right?
Yeah, that's right, actually. the rubber sword style of LARP in Ireland, there's a certain amount of interest in it, and they've tried to get some homegrown stuff off the ground a few times. It never really took off. Most people who are into that will have to travel to England to go to the big events there, and like they are pretty big. I haven't been to them because fantasy, frankly, makes my skin crawl, but you know, we're talking, I'm not sure the number of population at these games, but it's got forward numbers in it anyway. But yeah, so that last night a guy decided to sort of combine, well, okay, he decided this before last night, but he decided he'd go for sort of a post-apocalyptic setting so that he could mix in like airsoft guns as well as rubber swords. And so last night was the first one of these. There was a little under 20 players there. It's small, but it was good fun. There was almost no combat, which is good because I'm not particularly interested in that side of things. But just politically, like, you know, setting up a town council and arguing over various points of view and stuff. It was good stuff, and I'm hoping it'll get some traction. All right.
Something else that I'd like to talk about is what the gaming scene is like. And I realize it's kind of a vague phrase, so let me set this up a little bit. Over here, typically most people are introduced to role-playing games, sometimes through friends, maybe through family, usually through friends, high school, maybe college. They'll hang out with that group of friends. They may start to tap into a larger community either through the internet or more historically through the FLGS, the friendly local gaming store, where you go to pick up your products and learn about what's coming out and talk to the stuck up guy behind the counter or whatever the case may be. And then there's also very numerous conventions, from the really big conventions like Gen Con all the way down to the smaller conventions that may not have more than 20 people that show up for a game day together. So there's this, as I said before, a very bottom-up sort of organization, but there are these increasingly large layers of community that you can get tapped into through which you can be exposed to new ideas and such. And I'm curious what that scene is like where you guys are from. How do people get into games? How do you stay tapped into the community? As Chad talked about earlier, sometimes we feel a little bit compelled to keep our gaming habit on the down low. Yeah. Because while there may be numerically a lot of gamers in America, there are by percentage of population, there are not a lot of role players in America. It's getting better, but has historically been a very underground sort of hobby. And I'm curious what that scene in general is like for you guys. And Itamar, let's start with you, because I know a couple years ago, there was an article that came out about some issues that some role players were having actually with the IDF.
Yes.
So I'm curious to hear what things are like in Israel, where you've already even said yourself earlier in this podcast, the role-playing community is very, very small to begin with.
By percentage, I'm not sure it's smaller than the U.S., but because we're a tiny country, we've got a tiny community. But let's start with the what you were saying about the IDF. Turns out what was reported in the news...
Which is the Israeli Defense Force, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was reported that in the process of filtering candidates, because we have a draft here, so essentially everyone at age 18 is drafted into the army. But you get filtered and you get an interview. And it was reported that some people, after saying they were role players, would not be drafted, or they would be not allowed to get into military intelligence or various more important or more sought after positions. And I did a little research, and it seems this was misreported. It was exaggerated. This was about 4 years ago, I think. When I got drafted into the army, which was in 1997, I had this interview at the recruitment office, and I was asked what my hobbies were. And I was saying, one of the things I said was role-playing games. And one of the questions I was asked immediately after that was, do you think games are real? And I had this blinking light in my head going off, and like, if I say yes, I don't have to go to the army. But I unfortunately, I said, what, are you crazy? And that was that. But if we look, take a zoom out to the Israeli gaming scene, one of the things that I started at the age of, let's say, 11 or 12, because I bumped into the red box somewhere and introduced my friends, and like you were mentioning before, Dan, but one of the things I was surprised to learn, which are different in Israel than in the US and a lot of other countries, is that in Israel you have these after-school programs or classes which include role-playing. There are a few private companies which have role-playing classes for kids. It's mostly D&D, and they have like a DM or a game master for a group of anywhere from 5 to 15 kids, do a weekly game. And this is a way I think a lot of kids here get introduced to gaming. A lot of my gaming friends are not very happy with these classes because these are private companies. They want to make their money. Their goals don't necessarily include getting people into the hobby for the long run. They just want to have them for like 1, 2, 3 years, pay for the class, and that's it. So they do D&D, a lot of combat, not a lot of instilling into the kids that what is the essence of role-playing, or giving them the tools to do it themselves at home. But there you have it. That's what you've got. And
sorry, that's somebody's job.
Yeah, I've actually have three of my friends and former role-playing group mates were GMs for such groups. Two of them for companies, and the other was doing it freelance, and they got paid for doing it.
Nice.
So that's something that might be special in Israel. Other than that, you know, kids find out from friends or older siblings or family about role-playing games, and you play at home. And then we've got conventions, but that I think we'll talk about conventions maybe later.
We'll definitely come back to conventions. But something that I would like to ask about before we move on to the scene in another country is, what do you have in terms of game stores? And to be a little more specific, you live in Tel Aviv, correct?
I live in Holon, which is right next to Tel Aviv.
Okay, so I was pretty close. Do you guys have corner game stores like we would have? Well, they're not common everywhere in the U.S., but where we live in the Midwest, they are very common.
It's a simple answer. There are three specialty gaming stores in Israel. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, the three. One of them is Tel Aviv, one of them in Herzliya, which is close by, and another one, which is, I think, less about role-playing game and more about board games up north somewhere. And that's it. There was a fourth one in Tel Aviv that closed 6 months ago because it wasn't as profitable as they wanted. I knew the owner. So that's what you've got. You've got three stores. So the amount of people, kids or grown-ups, who get into role-playing because they went into the store and saw somebody playing or something like that is very, very tiny.
Which is interesting because I think St. Louis has a smaller population than Israel does. And I could think of at least five off the top of my head gaming stores that we have here. And then I know there's probably more that I just can't think of right now.
Yes, it's sad. Some of the problem is that we have to import everything. So gaming in general and role-playing is more expensive here. Not to mention that it costs even more if you have to do the translation. If off the top of my head, I can think of four, maybe five games that have been translated to Hebrew so far. It's been D&D in its various incarnations, Earthdawn, Shadowrun, Exalted, and very recently, Don't Rest Your Head was translated into Hebrew. I think that's about it. So the price is high and there are few stores. There aren't a lot of options in Hebrew.
Shane, what about you?
I guess it's probably pretty similar to the States in terms of how people get into gaming. Let's see, I'm in my early 30s now, and folks that I know who are into gaming, a lot of them started off with like fighting fantasy books and those choose your own adventure type of ones, you know, when they were kids, or maybe picked up a copy of Dungeon magazine or something that had an ad, and, you know, just constantly rereading the same little paragraph going, wow, that must be amazing, but not getting a chance to pursue it. There are a few people. It's an oral tradition, really. You know, if you know people who are into it, you'll kind of get dragged into it that way. But otherwise, it was mostly college where people that I know started gaming. Colleges will have a gaming club, typically. I don't know if that is the case in the States. I went to college in the States when I had my midlife crisis, but there wasn't a gaming club there.
It's hit or miss. Some colleges have it, some don't. Some high schools have it, and some don't.
Yeah.
Actually, it's I was just reminded that it's interesting. In Israel, a lot of kids that do get into gaming, whether it's role-playing or other types of gaming, quit when they go to the army. It's a major switch in your lifestyle and what you do, and a lot of people just quit gaming. So
that's strange.
That has a big effect on the gaming scene.
You often hear about like gaming being a big thing among soldiers in some countries. Like a lot of time spent sitting around a base or whatever. They seem to play a lot of games.
That's only soldiers who don't do anything.
Didn't Fear the Boot have some part in that military charity where they sent Dungeons and Dragons boxes to the U.S. forces in Afghanistan or Iraq?
Yeah, it was Iraq more specifically. But yeah, it's called Ziggurat Con. And actually, there's another one we're looking at starting with some guys we know that are either currently in or were recently in the military trying to do something similar for Afghanistan. Still in the works. I don't have all the details yet. But actually, what I've been told by some people, at least in the U.S. forces, even those that are very forward deployed, is that role-playing games are a little bit harder to play because you simply can't be transporting around books and maps and minis and, you know, all this kinds of stuff. But at the same time, they make a wonderful hobby because of the fact that when played a certain way, they are so driven by imagination and story that it's oftentimes your easiest and simplest way to emotionally escape for a little bit from the very difficult circumstances that you're under. And there was something that we linked off of the show notes, either from an episode ago or maybe two episodes ago, where a guy by the name of Cape Rust wrote about how in his experience in the military, he saw people improvising to play these games, swapping the components that we would normally use around a tabletop or in a prop heavy LARP for whatever it is they just so happen to have access to at the moment.
A lot of prop guns.
I hope they weren't waving those at each other, but either way, even though they were very busy, it was a very popular hobby simply because of the fact that it's so easy to do anywhere. I mean, it was as easy to do as telling a story, and of course, it's just there's a level of participation. But Shane, getting back to Ireland, so what do you guys have up there in terms of like game stores, conventions? So you said you get into the hobby about the same as you would in the US, but what about where it goes from there?
The convention scene is extremely lively, actually. I would say there's probably about 10 or so cons a year in the country. And because it's such a small country, like that's 10 cons that you can go to. So like there are a good number of people who would attend all of them or all but one or two. So you can certainly keep busy that way. They'll vary from being fairly small, like a small college's games club putting on a con. There's only one really independent convention at the moment, which is the one run by the Irish Games Association. So, well, there's some who wouldn't call it independent, but at the moment it's only getting about maybe 500 people, but it's sort of the big one. It used to pull in like over 1,000, but like the hobby is kind of declining, I think. Or maybe it's just kind of changing shape and the conventions aren't keeping up with what people are interested in now. I guess that's something to think about. And in terms of shops, it seems like it's a similar situation to Israel. I think we've got about four, one in each of the major towns, really.
So you're worse only one off because you're bigger.
Yeah, possibly. There's only one in Dublin, and but it's got, you know, nice tables, and the war gamers go in there to play. It's mostly focused around war games and board games, But they do have shelves of RPG books too.
Wargaming is really big over in Europe too. I don't know if it's bigger in Europe than it is in America, because I think that the genesis of it was more in Europe, and it's sort of come over here, especially with Games Workshop and whatnot.
Oh yeah, are we allowed to say their name out loud?
Yeah, go ahead.
They seem to be pretty touchy about stuff like that. Yeah, of course, I forgot about that. There are a number of their outlets around the country, but because they're so focused, it's easy to forget them.
Yeah.
There's one thing that all three of you, I think, have said, which is that you feel that role-playing is in decline in your countries. I certainly wouldn't expect you guys to have any kind of scientific research on this, but just in your experience or your conjecture, why do you think that is?
I don't think that the role-playing hobby is in decline. I think the industry is in decline. One of our largest producers of role-playing games, Riot Minds, just closed down their printing presses. They're releasing new material for their games, but they're doing it digitally instead, which is pretty much a blow to them, because in my opinion, the only thing they did well was physical books. The games suck. But, they have very good illustrators and they have extremely well-made books, and now they're taking them all away and I mean, I don't know, thinking that people like the game? No. But we have a pretty much a booming indie game market and small publishers. But what's declining is these big publishers that are trying to make a living out of this, which just does not work. And the cons are sort of, I mean, our largest convention, GothCon, which is a lot more jolly than it sounds. It comes from Gothenburg, which is the city it's situated in, has had, I think, 3,500 visitors at the most, I think, quoting from memory. But they have been declining a bit because there just aren't as much to go to cons for anymore. Because the newest books, well, you can get them online for very cheap if they're American games. And the Swedish games, there are fewer of them now from the big gaming companies. And the indie games are either published in PDF formats or print on demand, which doesn't get much cheaper on conventions anyway. I mean, I still go to cons because I usually work in one of the gaming stores for a very small, like, one-man sort of company. He lends me half of his table to have drawings on, so I mind half with games as compensation, sort of. So I still go there to work, but I haven't gone there to game for a good while because there just aren't many games that are released new that I'm very interested in, except the indie games. And the indie games are produced mostly by, I don't know, I just happen to know a lot of people who produce games. And so I don't need to go to conventions to try the games. I just ask them very nicely instead. So it's like, the thing that's declining is the industry, not the gaming hobby, I think. But the hobby itself is got a high threshold to come into, because you have to read a lot of rules traditionally, and you have to gather around a group of friends and get them really interested. Compare that to playing World of Warcraft for an evening, like getting a trial version of World of Warcraft, point and click, and it will explain itself to you, and you still get a very social experience. So I think it's not perhaps gaining many new gamers, because it's got a much higher threshold than many of the entertainment options available today, which probably is why so many few books are being sold.
I think that's the thing, is that it's harder to get into than it is to get out of. So the number of people leaving the hobby due to attrition, dying and getting married and things like that, is lower than the number of people who are starting it up because they could be playing video games instead. They just never get into the hobby. I think the crowd is getting older.
But you have to separate the hobby from the industry. I mean, the hobby of role-playing, role-playing doesn't actually... You don't need a new core book or source book or whatever. Mm-hmm. You don't need rules books.
You just need time.
You just need a lot of time, and you need to actually, well, try, I guess. Because most of my role-playing nowadays is actually done online in text, and not forums, but rather chats, so it's in semi-real time, I guess. Because that's just so much easier than to gather around a group of physical friends, when you can instead sit at different ends of the country. And that doesn't take any money. You just have to have a computer and an internet connection. But buying the books, it just doesn't make any sense anymore. Yeah. Especially not when the best games are indie games anyway, I think, anyway. And if I want pretty books, I'll just buy some blank ones and fill them in myself, I guess. But it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
I hear what you're saying, though. People have this notion that the industry and the hobby are the same exact thing. that they are inextricably tied to the hip. But you know what? Aliens can come down and hit the Earth with their anti-role-playing game, Ray, and disintegrate every single role-playing game book on the shelf and shut down every single role-playing game company in existence to where no one is commercially selling role-playing games anymore. Will the hobby die? No, you're talking about telling stories here.
It might, because some of the ways people get into the hobby is because they see a cool book or they see a demonstration in a store or something like that. And you, if you shut it down, you give less ways for people to get into it.
I think that I agree with and disagree. I think that there are people who get into the hobby from the proactive advertisements that the commercial companies do. But in my opinion, they don't do a very good job of it, and they don't do it enough. They are preaching to the converted. They're not ever trying to go out and get new people. But
that's true. Who picks up a Dragon magazine?
But I also, mean, on the other hand, who gets people into the hobby? You do. Your friends do. Podcasts do, as to sort of ring our own bell here. But it's people who find out someone.
You're also talking to the converted because you're a role-playing game podcast. And I think 99.9% of your listeners are role-playing gamers.
That's very true. And you know what? I think that role-playing game podcast or role-playing game independent media does not do enough to get new role players in.
I know a while back when we did episode 115, we did a 7-part, I think, miniseries. Mm-hmm. Or I say miniseries, it was 115 was broken down into 7 little chapters of about 5 or 10 minutes each that were meant to be put on a CD, given to a friend who doesn't get the role-playing hobby so they can come into it. And we have talked to a fair number of people who have said that that's exactly what they did. And in doing so, were able to either bring someone new into the hobby or to at least demystify the hobby to someone that's on the outside.
But you know what?
But we didn't do it. We created the episode. We created a tool, but we were not the ones out there talking
to
these
people. And you know what? That, as far as I'm concerned, that's not enough.
I agree.
You know, I think it should fall to the companies to advertise and to get their message out there to bring people into our hobby that aren't doing it because they have a financial motivation to. The more people who play their game, the more money they make. It's pretty simple. But they don't. Mm-hmm. They advertise to people who are already playing. And I see it as sort of the thing that happened in American comic books, where you have people who are into comic books and they're age 10, they're age 15, they're age 20. Well, there's no new people coming in at age 10 and 15 at 20. The 20-year-olds turn into 30-year-olds, and there's no new 20-year-old comic book readers to replace them, or if there's just one or two. And the comic book companies don't advertise to new readers. And you could say, well, they're making movies, but the movies are not them advertising comic books. It's them cashing out the IPs. It's
what I think that Itamar had a point in, though, is actually that one thing that draws people into a hobby is seeing that it is a physical thing. Mm-hmm. That seeing that this is a game you can play. And not only, I mean, if you demo a sort of a homebrew, you don't have any books or any pages maybe, then people will see you doing this activity. But if you have the books and the screen and the dice, they will see you doing this, playing this game, which makes it much more accessible. I could get these things too and play this game, rather than I can talk to these people that I don't know and try to see what they're doing. The physical things that are presenting the game can be pretty valuable in getting people to realize what you're actually doing. Mm-hmm. But and I'm what, not sure it draws people in very well, and well enough anyway.
And I'm interested in places like Shane and Jenny were saying, where they do have an organization. What does the organization does to enter new blood into the gaming sphere?
Well, one of the things they've done for a few years, I'm not sure if they do it anymore, they have something they call the National Gaming Week, which is a week that for some reason coincides with the autumn break in most schools, where they just give the clubs that say they're going to do some activity and trying to reach new gamers during this week some sort of help. Either some sort of money thing or some games. They sometimes put out little boxes of, you can try demo these things and try to make the clubs reach out, because Sverok represents itself on sort of fairs and other places where it can be of interest and with other youth unions and stuff. But the real dirty work has to be done by the clubs. And some of these are very well at doing this. I mean, this gaming week thing, I think, was a bit of a flop. But the conventions are pretty good at... because most conventions borrow schools. GothCon and the Stockholm convention both borrow very large schools. And so they preach a little bit because the people going to the schools will know that there is a gaming convention going on in their school this weekend. So they'll get a few students to come check it out and so on and so forth. I mean, but the problem Sverok has is that it has to rely on the clubs and they go about this very differently depending. And what my old LARPing group used to do was, because when I was 11, the year was 2001, or no, 2000, 2000, 2001, somewhere
you're
around
young.
There. Yes, I'm 21. And the Lord of the Rings movie was
who
coming
let
out.
That kid in?
Shut up, you. Anyway.
I'm only 10 years your senior.
She's one of Chris's kids.
Precisely. Anyway, Chris's grandson, obviously. Anyway, the Lord of the Rings movie was coming out. So they dressed up in the most knightly sort of clothes and stuff and had, well, rented some sort of rooms above the cinema to have some social things, and then we went down to watch the movie and stood there and sort of represented the hobby in relation to a film that we knew that people interested in medieval stuff and adventures would see. And we repeated this the following years. I think we even got to rent those rooms for free because the cinema was so happy we were making people interested in the movies. And we sort of recruited people from there. And we did the same with, what other movie was it? With some other medieval movies, some Swedish movies, Arn or whatever the name was. And Pirates of the Caribbean. They dressed up in pirate get-ups because they had just started some sort of group fraction within the LARPing World campaign, which was, of course, pirate-inspired. So they had been making these clothes for a year and just stood and looked nice. And people came and asked, what are you doing? And, well, they said, here's a flyer. So that's some ways that I've been involved in trying to get people to notice the hobby.
Shane, you said that there was a similar, albeit apparently somewhat disdained, organization in Ireland for gamers. And I'm curious, is there anything that they are doing to make some kind of an outreach for the hobby?
We do try to come up with ideas. What's going on at the moment is a sort of a convention outreach program where there's delegates being sent to other non-gaming but broadly related conventions like science fiction and anime because of how badly we want anime fans to come to gaming conventions. And so they'll sit at a table and play board games and just invite people to join in and plug the convention. So like that is a fairly ripe field to be trying to get new gamers from, I guess. If anybody's got any good suggestions.
Go to school
them while they're young.
Maybe it look cool.
Yes.
Have the state pay for games. Well, in Israel, the Role Playing Association has two major conventions a year. One in about April in Passover, which is strictly role playing, and the other in September, October, which will be at the end of this month, which is combined with movie science fiction convention. And they do a lot of outreach, and for the past year or so, it's been their main drive to do outreach. So in the last convention and the upcoming one, do things which you can't do at home. Do things in conventions which you can't do at home. For example, they're having a huge hall with a lot of tables, huge for Israel. I'm talking about a few hundred people as a national convention, yeah? A lot of few dozen tables in a big hall. And they're all running the same game with different game masters, but they're not running the same, let's say, adventure. Every group has its own bit of the story, and people can move from a table to another and experience different parts of the game. So, cool. So it's something you can't do with your group at home. And they also go and try and do, it's like a 3-day convention, and every day there's a section that is dedicated to a specific game system to get you like an intro to a game system, and then a session for like character generation, and then an actual play session. So you get introduced to a game, and then you can actually play that game. You get some background, and every day it's a different game. I think they're doing Exalted and two other games I don't remember this year.
So, the problem with plugging the hobby is that, I mean, I suppose if you've got the Swedish system there where it benefits you to expand your club, or in Israel where you've got companies that are actually making money from running games, then people have a motivation to go and do it. But if you don't have that, then, you know, this is your hobby time. This is your free time that you could be gaming, but instead you're going and explaining gaming to somebody who might not be interested. That's a pretty big sacrifice to make instead of playing a game, you know?
Well, I don't know in Ireland, but there are enough people, at least here, that find the outreach of games important enough for them and occasionally fun enough for them to do, in addition to their regular gaming. I've got a friend who was the secretary of the association, and he's all in favor of running games for noobs. He says that usually the average noob is a better role player than the average role player. Because he doesn't have the baggage that's involved. He doesn't have the set expectations and stuff like that. So a lot of people do find it important for themselves to do outreach for the hobby so they can have more people to play with, or their younger brothers or their children have someone to play with.
I think there's certainly something to be said for the desire of individuals to do outreach. Over here, of course, we have the presence of most of the large game companies. And while I think Chad's right that their advertisements are oftentimes perhaps maybe a little bit mistargeted, they tend to go after the converted instead of the other. But
they're selling more books to their customers they already have instead of selling...
Or selling books to somebody else's customers as opposed to really... I don't think it's entirely true, because I have seen a few efforts by the various companies to actually try and reach new audiences. But more often than not, when somebody is out proselytizing the hobby, it is a player of the hobby. It's someone who does not have a stake in one of these companies, as opposed to a marketing effort by one of these companies. But something that really this conversation kind of brought back to mind was, Shane, the way that you're describing tabletop role-playing games in Ireland is very much the way that I described LARPing in America. When we did the LARP roundtable, one of the questions that I posed to the guys that were on the mics with us is, I said, look, I do a podcast on role-playing games. I have played role-playing games for years. I go to these conventions. I go to the game stores. I am friends with more people in White Wolf than I am with any of the other companies. And yet I have never even heard of these things. I describe myself as a man who built his house on the train tracks and has never seen a train.
It's a good thing, you haven't seen a train if your house is on the train tracks.
But one of the things that came out recently, or at least came to my attention recently, is an effort, and I wish I could credit this correctly, but I can't remember who started this, and I'll try to put it in the show notes out of fairness to them, is read an RPG book in public. And this goes back something to what Jenny was saying, that even if the physical properties of the hobby are not necessary to the hobby, they oftentimes, I will agree, do make it seem more accessible to somebody else, because instead of a unique skill set that I have, this is a book they can go buy, read, and do themselves. And so somebody kicked off this effort of read an RPG book in public, of just take an RPG book you meant to read anyway, something you picked up at a convention or grabbed off Amazon or whatever, go sit in a park, go sit in a restaurant, go sit in a pub, and read that book there. And if somebody comes up to you and asks you what you're reading, or somebody sits down next to you and shows some kind of an interest in it, use that as an opportunity to spread the hobby, to keep this thing alive. I will agree with a point that's been raised a couple times in this episode, which is I don't think per se that the hobby is in decline, but certainly an aspect of it is in decline.
Yeah, I might have been misleading however it was that I said what I said that made you think that it's like LARPing here. I mean, I would say most people in the country would, you know, if you told them that gaming is your hobby, they would, you know that their neighbor's kid is into Warhammer or something like that. You know, they'll know that it exists, and if they wanted to track it down, they would be able to. I thought read an RPG book in public week or whatever it is was a great idea. I mean, I was doing that anyway, aren't we all? But
if you get over your gamer shame.
That's right.
I would read so many more role-playing books in public if they weren't all 10 foot tall.
I would read more books in public if I had time to read.
I think there are a lot of games, of course, that are published in smaller formats. A lot of my favorites, too. But most mainstream games, the ones that look spectacular, like the main Dungeons & Dragons books, they look very nice. They're always 10 foot tall. So I call shenanigans. before we can read books in public, make them book-sized.
So with Savage Worlds Explorer Edition.
I'm not sure. Anyone? I know I've read Savage Worlds, but if you say it's small, then...
It's the same book, yeah.
If you're wearing cargo shorts, you could real easily put it in a pocket. I don't know. You
Burning
couldn't.
Wheel is also pretty, in a pretty nice size.
Yeah, but it doesn't look impressive for an outsider. It just looks like any other book.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use this show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.